Hello and welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, and today we have a special episode to celebrate 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine and our stellar producers who are the power behind this program. Today I'm joined by three fabulous individuals.
Caitlin McPherson.
Moses Nagel.
Nico Nagel-Drabby.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. We are looking forward to getting to know you and to showcase your work. I'd first like to start with you, Caitlin. Caitlin, you were the first of the three guests here to join a Hudson Mohawk magazine. Why? What's the story behind joining up?
So I was in radio school looking for an internship during the pandemic. And a lot of the radio stations had closed their doors to people looking for an internship. And I reached out to our executive director, Steve Pierce, and he said, we'd love to have you. So I came on and did some promos and some stuff and helped them out. And then I enjoyed it. So I continued and stayed on and became a volunteer eventually and started producing stories. Am I too loud?
No, I think you're good. You could tilt it down a little. And Moses, you joined about a year ago.
It's just about exactly a year, I think. I'm an audio engineer, and I had some time on my hands, and I was imagining maybe I could pitch in with some audio engineering help, like some editing or mixing. And so I wrote to you, to Sina, because I knew you before a little bit, and said, how can I pitch in? And you said, well, we actually like our producers to do all that stuff themselves, so maybe not so much, but if you want to produce a story, we'd love to have you. And so I didn't think of myself as a journalist up to then, but I said, all right, sure. And you guys helped me find some topics to start with. And next thing I knew, I was on the phone with the city council candidates or, you know, covering concerts, and it was a lot of fun and very fulfilling.
And we'd like to make sure that there doesn't need to be overhead. So if you do your product from start to finish, and I'm surprised that you didn't think of yourself as a journalist because you've done some really kind of investigative, multi-perspective stories, which have been fantastic.
Yeah, I was a journalist maybe in my head, but it never had a chance to come out before.
And our current youngest producer here, Nico, what interests you about radio, and what was the first time that you remember getting involved?
I would pop in on the computer on Monday, and a lot of people saw me on the radio, and they liked it. And so then my dad decided I could do a radio story, and everyone liked that one, so I did one more.
Can you talk about some of the... We'll be hearing one of your radio stories later, one of your last, most recent radio stories. I remember hearing you for the first time on the radio in the library when it reopened. Do you remember that one?
Not really.
Maybe Moses remembers it.
I think that, yeah, we were interviewing the librarians when they were reopening from COVID, and you are such a fan of the library that you were there, and we just heard your voice as you were talking to people at the library, or maybe the librarians were talking with you too, because they all know you there. And then the first story you did was where you interviewed Barbara Dan, who's been your barber since you were like 3 years old.
Maybe even two.
Yeah, that was a pretty good one.
So what kind of stories do you like to do, Nico and Moses?
I feel like I end up doing a lot of stories about arts stuff and creative stuff, just because I'm not as experienced as digging into the harder news or whatever. But
I feel like the example that you picked out, though, exactly contradicts what
true.
You're saying.
Yeah, that's true.
But we'll get to that.
Okay.
And we can talk more about that.
Maybe I have a better answer. I like doing stories that have some sort of complex, something going on audio-wise beyond just an interview or something, because that's the more fulfilling ones to me, when I can play with some different sounds of whatever's happening in the moment or in the story.
Yeah, I would describe it that way too. And Kaylin, you also really like to
play with the dynamic audio.
Yeah. Both of you are one of our few producers who have like background experience in audio.
Right.
Yeah. Nico, would you say that there's something specific that you like to cover?
So the first time I was just first interviewing like a friend that been my like thing for a couple years, then I just got a little into it and started with other people that are kind of strangers to me.
That's harder probably, right?
Yeah.
Talking to the strangers was harder than someone you know? Yeah.
Well, great.
I think I came to appreciate, though, as much as I like to have the time to play with the sound, I came to appreciate the importance when you're a part of this project. Sometimes you have to like turn it over and get those stories done. And I feel like, you know, sometimes I don't hold up my bargain as just for content, for pushing out the content. But I appreciate how important that is to the production, to a volunteer production team.
Yeah, I think all of us probably feel that, where, you know, sometimes I don't get as complicated as I'd like. And Kaylin?
Same.
Yeah.
There's been times where I'm playing around with a bunch of different sounds that I've gotten from the internet, and then it just doesn't happen that it gets onto the take because it needs to get out.
The deadline's coming, and you got to upload it, right?
So, Kaylin, we're about to play your very first piece that you produced for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Could you set us up?
Actually, it was my second piece. I think my first ever piece was actually a live interview with Alexis Goldsmith.
Oh, that was before my time.
Yes. First piece that I did with you here. It was for I interviewed two students of the College of St. Rose. This was about a year ago.
More than a year ago.
More than a year ago? Okay. And at that time, the College of St. Rose was threatening to cut most of the music and arts. They have since cut most of those music and arts programs. And so these students were protesting. They had a petition going on. They were trying to save their classes, their school, the musics and the arts, and how important it was to them.
This is Kaylin. I am reporting for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today. I am talking with Lydia Flynn and Sarah Parisi. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what is going on with the College of St. Rose in the music department?
You can go first, Sarah, if you'd like.
Sure. So again, my name is Sarah. I'm 20 years old. I am a junior music education major at the College of St. Rose. And long story short, St. Rose is just not making decisions that really consider the student body as a whole and making a lot of cuts to the programs that they offer and affecting a lot of students in the process.
Any thoughts on this, Lydia?
Hi, I'm Lydia Flynn. I am sort of a junior. I'm going to be graduating after next semester. So I'm a music BA major. My major is being cut as well. I'm also a psych minor. And yeah, our majors are being cut without anyone really adhering to the student body as a whole. And just, yeah, it's been difficult for them to get to listen to us and actually, you know.
Is it the whole music department getting cut or is it just certain programs?
It's certain programs. It's like about 75%. So there's four music majors. There's BA, I'm music BA. Sarah is dead. Yeah. And then performance is also getting cut. And music industry. Music industry is the only surviving
music program.
Music program, yeah. And sure, it's great that's surviving, but everything else is getting cut. And the music, specifically the music ed degree, is one of the like first majors to be implemented by the college. It's about like 100 years old, and they're cutting that. And it completely violates, I mean, you can check the mission statement on the St. Rose website. It's violating what the mission statement states about, you know, offering the liberal arts education and supporting the education of educators, future aspiring educators. And even with the music industry kids, they're going to be losing, you know, because everything else is getting cut, like including general music classes like music history, music theory, I'm going to say, except like contemporary harmony, because that's what the music industry kids get. But big classes like those are going to be removed, and that's still going to impact their overall liberal ed, like education that was promised by the school, but kind of isn't at this point.
Yeah. So all of the majors in the music department work together very closely. We share a lot of faculty, we share a lot of resources, all of that. So cutting these majors not only harms, you know, the majors who are being cut, but it also does affect music industry. Because, like, yes, the college said that they will make accommodations so that we can still get our degree and our classes, but it's not going to be taught by the professors that, you know, we all know and love and trust. So
exactly. And even so, like, they're just, I mean, even what Sarah was saying, like, we're such a close-knit group, and it's almost like we're kind of like at each other, and not like, you know, like, we're in a really difficult position where we're kind of like split up, if that makes any sense. And there's been like, it's been not so great to like our family as a whole, and it's been, you know, detrimental to like the connections that we've made. And it's even more painful to see, at least from my standpoint, to see my professors that I've known for almost 3 years now lose their jobs that they've worked so hard for, some of them being here like way long before than I was. Some of them like worked in like started working like the late 90s, like 96 I heard one of them worked there, and they're getting cut and they're fully tenured, and I'm close with a lot of them, and they've done so much for not just me but everybody and people before me. And yeah, not to mention there's so many music educators who come, not just educators but performers, who come out of the St. Rose like music program, and it's going to be cut. And then, you know, where are the educators going to come from? Because everyone rely the community, it's going to impact the community is what I'm trying to say. Like, just every, there's so many people who rely on this program when it comes to like getting their music ed degrees, and like, where are we going to get our educators from to teach young kids music and inspire them? And more than just that, like, I'm not the educating person like Sarah is here, but I'm sure she can agree with me, right?
100%.
Yeah.
Just to budge in here.
Yeah, sorry.
The interview running. Why do you think the school cut the program, the music department programs? Or do you guys not know? Or
the college said that they cut it due to financial strain on the college. The college has been in debt since 2013, almost filed the bankruptcy, I want to say, in 2017, but I could be slightly wrong about that. It could be 2016. It's in that area. And they said that the only way to save the school would be to cut all of these programs so that they could continue having a college at all. However, they could have made so many different decisions and different cuts and different ways to save the same money that wouldn't have involved cutting such foundational programs at the college. And we've tried to tell them this and they just won't listen to us. They won't even hear us out.
Right. And I've even heard some other like college, like people who work with the college in different departments say that like, oh, like your program is small, it doesn't mean anything. No, we have like one of the largest programs like as a whole. There's so many like music students that exist on campus, and I've even heard from a friend recently, like, it's hard to like not even spot a music major, like they're everywhere. We're a very big group. And yeah, we don't definitively know, like, I mean, yeah, with the financial stuff, but there's still a lot unsaid that we don't know about, and we want those answers, and they won't give them to us at all.
That's crazy. I if I was a student, I'd want those answers. An optimistic world, do you think they would bring back the programs maybe in the far down the road future?
I would like to think so. I mean, even now we're fighting so hard to get it back because it obviously means the world to us. I mean, it's quite hard to see that future because it's such a bleak reality that we're living in, that we're going to be losing our so many people and teachers that are so close to us. Yeah, I mean, I hope that we can still I hope that we can still fight for it and have it back, and maybe, and you know, or at least like you said, down the road for it to come back. Sarah,
I think that they don't really see how big of an impact this is going to have on the school, because as Lydia said, like, the music department makes up such a large part of the community. Like, not only are we students, but almost like half of the RAs on campus are music majors. Like, it's going to make a very large impact, and I don't think they're thinking about that. So I think after a couple years they're really going to realize how much it's affecting the school in a negative way, and they might try to reverse it. But I sincerely think that with these cuts that St. Rose is making, and the fact that they're not not thinking about the outcomes of these decisions, St. Rose is going to crumble and fall within the next 5 years. So there won't be a school to bring these majors back to.
Yeah. And to add, like, again, they're kind of violating the mission statement by cutting music out of a liberal arts school. And there are so many music majors that exist. And, you know, it may not bring as much money as other departments, but it's still a really big department that does bring in some cash. So I see it crumbling and falling too, to be frankly honest.
So to get this correct, the College of St. Rose is a predominantly music-based college.
Well, it's liberal arts. So
liberal arts, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, they are. It is a liberal arts school. However, they are cutting every single art program that is offered at the college and yeah. all but one music program. So all that is going to be left are the majors that you can get at any school across the country.
That's crazy.
So everything that makes St. Rose unique is going to be gone, except for music industry. And I understand that music industry is their biggest program of music, and it brings in a lot of people and a lot of publicity. Julia Gargano graduated from the music industry program, and she went on to be on American Idol and brought in a lot of attention to the school. And I recognize that. However, part of the appeal of St. Rose is the broad array of majors that we have in each of these programs, and that's going to be gone. So right. while the school doesn't revolve around music as a whole, these arts programs do make up a very large portion of campus.
Will you guys continue at the college, or will you change what you're studying or go to another college?
I very heavily considered transferring. I almost did. I wasn't even sure that I was going to stay until this past month. And the only reason that I am staying and not transferring is because all of my credits will not transfer, and I will end up having to take an extra year of school, if not more, requiring me losing even more money. So it just, in the long run, wasn't worth it. I decided to overload credits instead to get out a little early if possible. However, yeah, I almost transferred, and I know a lot of people who are and or are switching their majors. So,
as do I. There are a lot of younger people. I don't think we mentioned this either, but Sarah and I are technically like the least impacted out of all of the juniors and seniors are like the least impacted when it comes to like finishing our degree. But when it comes to the sophomores and juniors, yeah, sophomores and freshmen have a bit of a harder time. Like yeah. we graduate, but it may not be a possibility for them. Is that right? Okay.
Their programs, their degree is going to be drastically.
Most of the programs have shut down. There's still some there, but I as I've heard, they're still going to start slashing even more.
And what interested you in this story at the beginning?
It just, I mean, I was searching for stories and I found this one, and I felt like that I didn't see any news coverage of it. And so I felt important for me to cover this as a reporter that and get coverage of it, you know, and I had a connection too, which made it even easier to do this interview, to connect. And afterwards, that after I stopped recording that interview, I had a conversation with Atham, and they really appreciated me getting this word out. It was very important that they got the word out.
How does this relate to other work that you've done?
I mean, I've done Is Radio Dying show, and you could relate it with that because radio, I always thought, is part of the arts. It's part of, is a medium. It's a art medium. And so I thought it could relate to radio as a medium, you know, because you can use it for music, you can use it for news, you can do so much with it. It's very versatile.
I think that is really related too, because those Is Radio Dying is about the sort of hollowing out of a art form, and of, you know, that has all this tradition. And this is also, you know, St. Rose had this really great music program and technical and performing music, and it's got gone. Hollowed
theater,
out just from
art, yeah,
from budgetary concerns.
So our next piece is from you, Moses. Could you set it up for us?
So this was in June 2021, and actually my daughter was working at the co-op, and I also am a member worker at the co-op. So I'd sort of, she was a cashier. So I'd heard firsthand some of the sort of horror stories of being a service worker with the public during with the mask mandate in place, and how much of the burden of enforcing these mandates fell on the just regular working people. Not, you know, management would issue the mandate, or even, you know, they came from the government, right? But there would be so many customers that would complain about it, that would yell at them and berate them, call them, Nazis and stuff when they're just, and it fell on them to enforce it. So they had, this was right when the government said it's up to each specific place whether they want to do it or not. And so they were in this kind of gray area with the mask mandates. And I noticed that the workers had like really mixed feelings because they were nervous about being around, being exposed a lot. But at the same time, they were really tired of having to enforce these rules themselves. So I thought that was a really, interesting thing. And I'd also heard about, I was also kind of intrigued by the people that were so angry about this, kind of intrigued me, because it's hard for me to relate. Like I don't like wearing a mask any more than anybody else, I think, but to like have it as a reason to berate and scream at someone who's doing their job was hard for me to really understand. So as the mask mandate was lifted, I thought it would be really interesting to talk to some people that worked at grocery stores and those kind of things. And then I knew that Kalen also worked at a local store. So I talked to some people at the co-op and I talked to him. And I thought that was an interesting angle that wasn't represented too many other places, maybe. Going shopping has, in the last 6 months, become a polarizing experience. For some of us, wearing masks and dealing with lower store capacity has just been an adjustment and an inconvenience. To others, it has felt like a genuine encroachment on rights and freedoms. On May 13th, the CDC announced a new guideline that said that people who have been vaccinated do not need to wear masks or practice social distancing indoors or out. 3 days later, Governor Cuomo announced that New York State would follow the guidance and no longer require businesses to enforce mask wearing. For local groceries and food service workers who have continued to work throughout the pandemic, this was a mixed and confusing transition. I talked with Kalen McPherson, a reporter for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, who also works for a local grocery store.
So the CDC came out, and then they wanted to wait to see what the governor did. And then once the governor called that we don't have to wear masks, they changed that the customers, it's up to them whether or not they wear their masks or not. We still have to wear masks as employees, and then, if someone's not wearing their masks, there's not much we can do anymore.
How was that changed policy transmitted to the customers?
Mostly either through the news or word of mouth from the store.
So did you notice an immediate change?
Right after the store changed their policy, or even right before that, after the governor came out saying you didn't have to wear masks, there was an increase of people not wearing masks.
Did the management in the store like address the employees in any way to prepare them for it or ask how they felt or anything like that?
No, we never heard anything. We never knew that was going to happen. We were told at one point just to wait before to hear from corporate what they want us to do, and then I never heard anything. When it first happened, when we first had the masks come off, we were still enforcing it at that time. And so people were like, why are you enforcing it? Because we haven't changed our rules yet, so you're still required to wear masks. So people would get mad at us, and they were almost attacking us. And it's like, I'm just enforcing what I'm told to enforce. I'm not being mean in a way. I'm just doing my job.
Is part of you relieved to not have to fight with people anymore and deal with that?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. You don't have to fight with people. And most people, they'll come up to the register and ask, do you want me to put a mask on? Like, we get those people, and we're like, it's up to you. We can't require you to put a mask on. We're fine.
But I imagine that a big chunk of your coworkers are vaccinated at that point. So does it make them feel nervous or?
Yeah, most of us are vaccinated, and most of the employees say we're continue to wear our masks. Even if we're not in this store or even another store, we're going to continue to wear our masks right now just to see how it plays out. It's actually kind of funny to see that most of the employees want to wear their mask. It's not like that they don't want to wear their mask and the store is saying you have to. It's most of them are like, sure, I'll keep wearing my mask. Like, I want to. Like, I'm still, scared to take it off.
Anything else you want to say just about working with people in this type of position in public?
just for people to know that when you walk into the store and you see us behind the desks, you know, we're trying to save safe as much as you can, so just cooperate with us, you know. If we have to wash down the belt because we're still required to wash down the belt, let us wash down the belt, you know.
Alex Mitakis is the head of marketing for Honest Weight Food Co-op and was part of the group charged with adapting the store's policy. He said that when the CDC and state rules changed, the store was in a difficult spot.
Yeah, so it was, you know, it was so complicated coming into this, and I think it's proving to be just as complicated as we, knock on wood, come out of it. Honestly, I read all the responses when we get emails and Facebook comments from anti-mask people or from anyone. That's part of my job. And my go-to thing here has been copy and pasting the CDC and New York State guidance and saying, look, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. I'm just following what the experts are telling me to do here, telling us to do. And we're following the best guidance available from the professionals. And that's been like our backbone this whole time. So as soon as the CDC and New York State said they're changing that, it's like, are we gonna waffle here and say, you know what? I'm not sure that we believe what the CDC and New York State are saying anymore. I think we know better. I think we want to make our own rules now. After we had so strictly and so cautiously followed for 15 months every word the CDC and New York State said. And on top of that, our staff who have to enforce these rules are already so burnt out and so tired and so sick of arguing with people. I mean, it's daily, and it was daily that we would have people come in and argue the mask rule. A big part of my job has been responding to written complaints and people threatening to sue us and people, you know, saying they're going to boycott us and you better watch out for a protest this weekend, those kinds of things. And we saw that with this change, if we're the only store or one of the only stores still doing this, that the volume of those kind of things is just going to increase massively and put this huge undeserved burden on our staff, you know, who have to deal with it every day.
Another local grocery store worker recalled the chaos at the start of the pandemic.
Everything was really super confusing. Everything was super hectic. There was also a lot of confusion, especially in the beginning, as to whether or not we were supposed to be wearing masks. I believe in the beginning, someone started wearing a mask before the mandate went out, and they were criticized by other employees for causing mass panic. I thought that there were a lot of people who were really respectful often, but I also found that there were people who really did not seem like they cared about other people's safety.
She told me that changing the rules did not mean that confusion and difficulties with people upset over store policies ended.
They didn't tell anyone on the floor before they changed the mask mandate. They didn't tell anyone working. And so I actually told someone to please put up their mask, and they said, no, I don't have to, and did this whole big blowout, and then went to go ask the front end about it, and came back to yell at me that he did not have to wear his mask and that I was wrong. The fact that he was allowed in the store meant that he was just allowed to aggressively interact with more people.
Does it make you feel more unsafe?
I would say that I feel unsafe. I don't trust that the honor system of wearing a mask if you're vaccinated is happening. So I don't trust these people couldn't give me COVID, honestly. I don't believe that the vaccine is 100% safe. And even if it is, you should only be really interacting with other vaccinated people. And so it just adds a whole nother level of danger to the job that is really hard to avoid if your job is on the floor.
Some shoppers at local stores had differing opinions about shopping with unmasked people.
It's tough because I'm mentally not at a point where I can just like rip it off and go in and like go about my day. And I understand other people's willingness, but it's tough because the onus is on, it's hard to tell apart, you know, who's vaccinated and who's not. And so when I walk in, I'm like, did they do it? Did they not do it? But I'm also trying to keep in mind that, you know, we're getting to a point where more people are vaccinated. So if there's one person that's not masked and not maxed, it's like, maybe that's okay.
Alex Mitakis told me that at times it has been overwhelming, but he also thinks about how the majority of customers and owners at the co-op have pulled together in difficult circumstances.
I mean, it's been like a really wild social experiment, right? Watching this all kind of happen and unfold, and we all never thought we'd have to deal with something like this ever in our lifetime. And here we are, we're almost 15, 16 months in. And I guess overall, I've been pretty happy with, at the co-op at least, with how people have treated each other. Like, I talked a lot about the negative, I guess, in our conversation, but overwhelmingly, I think that I've been pretty impressed with humanity and how you know, I guess I'm in a bubble here at the co-op, and for everything negative I just said, I mean, everyone's been overall really awesome, and I've seen a lot of really inspiring things and people really stepping up to help each other out. And yeah, I'm feeling like we're getting close to the end and coming out on the other side of this. I'll knock on wood again, but I guess that's kind of my overwhelming thought to try to stay positive.
Last week, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which has 1.3 million essential workers as members, called on stores to maintain mask mandates. Its president, Mark Perrone, said in a statement, "These essential frontline workers have been forced to play mask police throughout the pandemic, with many shoppers not following COVID safety standards. Now they are being asked to be the vaccination police." Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
So what was that reporting like? We heard from many different voices in there. How difficult was it to create that story?
I don't think it was that difficult. I think it was, at that moment, the people that I talked to were sort of, actually were kind of excited to tell the story and to hear, like, to have someone listen to what they'd been going through. So I think the story was pretty easy. I just, you know, it was people that I knew, and the Alex, who was like the head of sort of public relations at the co-op, was, I mean, it was his job to talk to people and press, so he was willing to do it. The thing that just intrigued me the most, and that I just never felt like I solved the answer to, was the other side of it, and the mm-hmm. people that were so angry about it. And I kind of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole on another story following up on it, where I like joined the Facebook group to stop masks being worn in schools. And I interviewed a few people in that respect, but I still feel a little mystified by that side of things.
And you're able to really turn around some complex pieces really quickly because you have that experience. And so it's great because we've got a range of abilities and perspectives on our program, which is, I think, one of our big strengths. And Kaylin, we have another segment coming up. This is from a series. Could you introduce it, please?
So this series, it's called Is Radio Dying? And it started out basically interviewing people who are in the radio business, or a host on a radio station, or an executive director of a radio station, or somebody who's been in the radio business, and just talk to them about what radio is looking like. You know, the pandemic has definitely affected radio in so many ways, and what the future of it is. You know, our younger listeners like Nico here listening and using radio to our full effect. So I was very interested in seeing what other people's opinion about radio was from inside the business.
This is HMM correspondent Kaylin McPherson reporting. Can I have you introduce yourself?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Reverend Joan Ross. You want my whole title, huh? Okay, yeah. I'm Reverend Joan Ross. I'm the station manager for WNUC 96.7 FM out of Detroit, Michigan.
What is your experience in radio?
Wow, we started community radio here in Detroit in 2017. So I've been in radio acting as the station manager, and I do a show called My Block, My Hood, My City out of Detroit.
So how do you think a listener listens to radio now, you know, opposed to even the beginning of this decade?
So I think that radio listenership is up, especially for us. We're in an urban area that is very dense with radio stations, radio signals. However, they're not really connected to community. And being a community radio station, we find that people are connected to us basically primarily for the community information, to be a part of that community.
And then in terms of listenership, does your listenership include younger listeners? Is it hard to get younger generation excited to tune into radio?
Actually, no, not for us. We have a young listener base that we start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we actually turn our airways over to our young folks. They produce a show called Radio to the Future, where they can have their own content at their own time. So when they get out of school, they head to the station and produce their own show. So no, it hasn't been as challenging trying to get young listeners as it probably is in other markets.
How do you think the pandemic has changed the radio industry or even just your local radio station?
Well, certainly we've had to switch from the studio to remote. We're doing everything remotely. So that does affect the impact of folks in the studio, people coming to produce shows. They're more able to produce the show because they're at home, but we had to learn a whole new technique in doing that. So I think that the pandemic drove us all indoors, but it also gave people opportunities to create shows and create content that before didn't have that special time to do.
And then have people, for us at our radio station, is have people not just in our local area help us produce the show, but from all over the country.
Yes. We're getting content from everywhere, not just all over the country, but we get a lot of content from out of the country. We're so close to Canada, and you may be well too. I don't know exactly where your station is located, but we get a lot of folks from Windsor, from Montreal, from Toronto, submitting content as well.
Yeah, we're not too close to the Canadian border, about 6 hours away. Anyways,
I'm about 6 minutes.
Nice. Where do you see radio in 20, 30 years?
You know, I think a lot of people thought radio is dead, but we have to remember radio is still in our cars and people are still connected to that when they get in cars, even though there's Pandora and some of the other services that come through streams. People still use radio primarily in the cars. So as long as we have that lifeline to a car, especially for us here in Detroit, I think that radio is going to grow. While it does seem to be a little stagnant in some areas, I believe that there are areas across the country, such as Detroit, probably New York, where you are making comebacks with radio and radio content. It's the last place that community has to get its message across. It's the place where local people can create content and actually get it aired, have an opportunity for their music to perform, to create talk shows. So I don't think it's time to count radio out. I think radio is going to grow. It's going to make a comeback.
WNUC looks like it has a pretty diverse amount of shows, not just new shows, but some music shows, some news shows, and it doesn't even look like some of them are even like you got Democracy Now, which is definitely not produced in-house. So it's right. An assortment of shows, correct?
Yes. We have about 60% of our content is created in Detroit or in Michigan, and the rest of it is in syndication.
I mean, the other thing is I think people are also listening to it on their phones too now. Is you can listen, you can just pull up a radio station, listen to it on their phone too.
Yep. Absolutely. I do that. I mean, that's how I get radio through my phone.
Right. And the most important question, and it's the name of the series, do you think radio is dying?
Oh, I don't think radio is dying. I think that, and especially as more people realize community radio or locate community radios in various areas, I think that gives radio new birth, new life. It's not the usual loop that may be in commercial radio. Community radio brings spice, it brings difference, It brings diversity. It's that place where folks can, we have programs from all kinds of groups, all kinds of cultures on our station, because that's what Detroit is about. We have a lot of different cultures that blend together. And I think radio is the place, the perfect place for that to happen.
Anything else you'd like to add or anything else that I didn't ask?
Well, you know, I think the listeners that are listening to your show are a prime example of those people that are moving. You're from a younger generation than I am. And if community radio has caught you and it's caught your listeners, then I think that's the target. Those are the folks. And I believe that we've got the right vehicle. We've got a vehicle that people can afford. They don't have to worry about subscribing. They know we're changing content. It's fresh. It happens. It's popping. And it's relative to where they live right now.
Right. Opposed to like other stations that do national, international news. We're focused on local news.
Right.
Which is
absolutely.
Which is good.
Right.
Because there's stories that I don't even know that's happening in my local area. And then I hear it on our radio station or one of the local radio stations. And I'm like, oh, that's happening. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, we do a lot of organizations with what's going on. The idea of our call letters is to unite community, North End uniting community. So community can unite here with those things that you thought you were in a silo doing or you were in a silo experiencing. Once you put them on community radio, you find, hey, this is something that helped everybody in my town.
Well, thank you, Reverend Joan Ross, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great afternoon and good luck with community radio there.
Thank you. And this has been Kaylin, and this has been another episode of Is Radio Dying?
And there's a lot of that sound.
That's
there.
A cool ending.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Ken, I think this is a really useful series and really interesting. So what was your connection with radio that inspired you to get into this? What made you want to dig into the sort of bigger picture and the way it's disappearing and, or the way the whole industry is kind of being affected in that way?
I felt that my generation and after wasn't listening to radio. They were streaming on music station or streaming services. And so I thought it was important to talk to other radio stations and try to see what they were thinking. And also we had just had a pandemic. So I was also curious about what the direction of radio was going. And also just reaching out to and see how the other radio stations work and how they do their stuff differently than ours.
Right. I share your love for radio that way. So I appreciate this series.
Do you feel like talking with all these different radio personalities has helped you to just reaffirm your love for this medium?
Yes. Short answer, yes.
And what are some of the things that have stuck with you?
Well, for those believers who think radio is dying, it is not. It is alive and well, and it's just changing. I think most people will start using their phone to listen on their phone through apps, and it'll just transform. But the other thing is you can listen to any radio station across the country and they're going to do their shows, their programming different than any other radio station. And that is very interesting to me that even the big commercial stations, they all do it differently. Yeah, we all have formats, but we all do it differently.
So we do have one more piece coming up, and that is from our current youngest producer at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Yeah, Nico, do you know which piece we're about to play, and could you introduce it?
So this is one that was played at Grafton Lake about heat wave and how you cool off during it if you're not at the lake or there and how if you have a special kind of swim or vacation.
It was during the heat wave, so it was like a 98 degree day. Right,
ooh,
and
hot.
We went to Grafton.
with my grandma.
Right. You said it was hard to go talk to strangers and ask them these questions. How do we do that?
So we just went really up to them and said, I work for a radio, and we just said if they could I could ask them some questions, and they got to say
nobody
yes.
Nobody said no to like a 6-year-old radio interviewer.
Yeah.
But my favorite part was when you were talking to the kids and asking them, and they were kind of shy, like you were saying, what do you do when it's hot? And they were shy and didn't want to talk to you, but then you were just like, they were digging a sandcastle. So instead of asking them like what they do on a hot day, you were just like, so what's your plan with the sandcastle? What's going on here? And then they started telling you all about it.
Nico, does it get easier to approach strangers the more that you do radio interviews?
Kind of.
All right, so let's play it.
My name is Nico. I'm reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And we're thinking about when it's past 90 or about 90. This year it's been calling the heat wave. And this is a story about how people are staying cool in the heat wave. Reporting from Grafton Lake, a nice place you can cool off.
Find a seat, boys. Find a seat.
How deep do you usually go?
Well, it's not very deep for me. To my shoulders, I guess.
Do you swim or just walk?
Well, I'm usually carrying her, so.
No diving. So,
Emily,
how does she cool off if she's getting carried?
She splashes. She can't swim yet. She's still pretty little. So she splashes in the water.
Do you have any other ways to cool off?
Drink cold drinks. Icy drinks.
You have a tent here, too.
Yes, yeah, that's true. I like the shade. I don't like being in the sun.
So where do you come from?
Avril Park, New York. We're from Avril Park, which is about 20 minutes from here, 25 minutes from here.
Oh, so you're not coming for a vacation?
No.
You're just coming for a beach day?
Come for a beach day. Very cool.
And so how do you stay cool here?
Well, I've gone swimming 3 different times so far since I've been here.
And I've got the
umbrella. We have an umbrella and we have hats. Yeah. And we're getting a sunburn anyway. How do you stay cool?
Well, I swim too, and I have a tent, you see?
Yeah, I saw that.
I have some drink, and you're not like at Grafton Lake. How do you cool off? What's the best way?
The house is air conditioned. Yeah. But you know what? I don't get hot a lot of times unless there's a lot of humidity. If it's 90 degrees and there's not much humidity, I can walk for 4 or 5 miles, and I can mow 4 or 5 lawns by hand. But once the humidity comes, like today it was brutal. Yeah.
But we haven't really had this hot of summer in years, I would say.
You want to do it?
You didn't know you were going to be on a radio show.
Come on, Zach, you can do it.
How big is this sandcastle going to get? Are you like halfway done?
It's not a sandcastle. It's a mini lake.
Is it going to get bigger or deeper?
Maybe.
You're making the wall there?
Yes, it's a wall.
She's digging a little bit and making a little wall too. What's your name?
My name is Zach.
Is that your sister?
Yes.
And what's her name?
Vivian.
When you're like at your house, how do you keep cool?
Sometimes we get out of an inflatable pool.
Yeah, we have a little pool, but it's nice to come to the lake.
Let's the turtle go.
How many times did you come here? Is this like a new like trip, or like you've been here a lot? So how old are you?
I'm 9 years old.
Is your sister a little younger or the same?
She's older.
You see this?
Yeah,
10?
She's 10. Yeah, 10.
She's doing some big work, I see. Digging on a big hole.
We make it as deep as we want before we put the water in because more wet sand just comes and fills that part in. Sometimes I like to make it wider by just moving the walls. But sometimes that creates problems and then one of the walls collapses.
Did you go swimming here or did you just get here and not yet?
Yeah, I've been swimming for like a few hours in water.
Already?
Yeah.
How do you cool off here?
In here? I don't. No. We got fans going. The fans help us.
That's just the, you only have one?
Yeah, we have one fan. It's hot.
Where do you come from?
Where do I come from?
Mm-hmm.
Troy.
What foods do you serve and what foods do people like?
Fried dough, mozzarella sticks, and lemonade. And ice cream, right.
So how do you stay cool if you're up down there?
So a lot of us like to go out in the water. We take the rescue boards out and we like to go for a swim in the lake. That cools us off a lot of the time.
Do you do that in the morning, or do you have a certain time?
Whenever we have a break. Whenever it's super hot and we have a break. And
you
we
just
have a
practice?
Chance. Yeah, sometimes we'll do some training, practice some rescues out there.
Oh, cool.
My brother's a lifeguard, but he haven't had to save anybody, but did a lot of whistling.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, they say that the best lifeguards never actually have to save anyone.
So he must be a really good lifeguard.
Yeah, preventative lifeguarding.
Where are you from? Are you from here?
I'm from Brunswick. I'm from, like, outside of Troy.
And I'm from Grafton, so right here.
I'm all the way from East Greenbush.
Are you all, like, ending school soon? Or?
We all have to start school soon. It's almost the end of summer, so we're all about to go back to college. Until you're ready?
Yep.
Oh, Mommy wanted you to ask if they had a shortage and they couldn't find enough lifeguards this season. Just we heard about the lifeguard
we did have
shortage.
A huge shortage.
Yeah, normally we have over around 20 guards. This year we have 12.
Are they all around or only like over here?
So today we only have 5. Well, now we have 6 of us. Those two up on the chair, those two going down, and us two today.
Not very many breaks today, so we didn't have much time to go swimming.
Did you ever rescue anybody?
I haven't had to rescue anybody, but we do a lot of first aids and a lot of whistling at people who don't follow the rules. People getting overheated or who get cuts or bumps and bruises. And
how do you do that? Do you like, if they're like, if they're too hot, what do you give them?
If they're too hot, we usually give them some water and bring them inside out of the sun and maybe some ice to cool them off.
How long have you been working?
This is my second summer here, so.
This is my third.
Couple years.
What grade are you going in?
I'm going into my sophomore year of college. What grade are you going into?
Second
grade.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank
you,
you for all the questions.
So how do you get cool?
I'm just naturally cool.
Where do you live?
We live in Troy. And this is our daughter and grandchildren. And they are from England. Visiting.
So then what do you do at home?
That's a good question. We use fans, like electric fans,
We don't really have an air conditioner, too. We have some fans, right? So you learned when you were 4, you said?
Yes.
And you almost drowned?
No. I did a doggy paddle. Like
this. So you're 9?
Yes.
Do you know all the swim lands or just some?
Some.
I made this one up the back arm spin. It does this.
Wow, great.
I messed it up a little.
Now that's
when I was little.
We're not taking a picture of this. So you kind of like turn upside down, turn up again.
Like, what were you doing when the first, like, move? Doggy paddles, I don't really count because they're swimming. But what was, like, the first, like, backstroke or just a move?
I would say my very first move, I didn't even know that it was invented. I was like, like I told my grandma that I can swim, and I started doing this.
Wow. Great first move. It started to rain here. Let's pack it up. I'm Nico Nagel Drebby, reporting from Grafton, and let's go home.
That ending is so perfect. It's almost like if you were scripting a film, it was like, now the rain starts. It's like this, you know,
reporter
little,
walks
little
on.
Closure.
Yeah. Oh, and I think we were in our little, we have the little like sun tent.
Yeah.
So that really amplifies the noise of the rain on it. It was perfect. Yeah.
Was that scripted? Did you plan it out ahead of time?
Not really, because it all really came out that whole day.
Yeah. Well, you love that you're like, okay, and let's go home. So, Nico, for our listeners who might think, oh, well, I have no talent, I can't get into radio, what are some tips that you would have for people who want to do some radio?
So it's really, if you do this interviewing, it's just asking people questions about a certain thing.
Would you say curiosity is a really important part of being a radio producer?
Yeah, you could like ask your best friend like about his job or whatever. I just ask, or even ask like me, like ask people like at the grocery how they got to work here. It helps me like how to like ask people questions and not be scared to just ask people questions.
I get scared too sometimes to ask people questions. Like I get a little bashful and shy as well. So working, doing this with Nico is great because like I said, who can say no to the 6-year-old? he's great that way. But he also, I thought he was very good at like, at finding the right questions actually to ask people. Once he started thinking about it, he was very thoughtful like that.
And why did you start to get Nico involved?
It was just so like people could enjoy the radio and like be like, oh, there's other wow, it's nice to see like kids or your best friends on the radio. It's just nice to.
But it's also been such a great outlet as like, first of all, as someone who's not great at like striking up a conversation all the time, having that as an excuse to get into some situations I might not have, and then doing it, some of it with Nico and my wife Joanna has been interviewed and done some interviews that we've turned into stories too. So it's actually been really fun to all kind of get involved. And I think it's such a great project.
Yeah, really? Definitely shout out to Joanna because we've heard her voice on here.
It's fun,
right? It's a little family affair.
Radio's for families. There you go.
Caitlin, you're also a regular co-host on Tuesdays.
Co-host on Tuesdays, and then I fill in an engineer when Sina needs a break from engineering.
Any last thoughts before we wrap this up?
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Every thought is thanks.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you guys.
And Sina, thank you for, you know, keeping this show running, you know.
You guys are keeping it running, so thank you so much. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey with our incredible producers. We have Kaylin McPherson, we have Moses Nagel, and we have Nico Nagel-Drebe. And this is a volunteer-run program, and we appreciate all of our producers who make this show possible. Thank you for celebrating 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine with us. And if you would like to get involved, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or go to mediasanctuary.org for more information and our full archive of stories. We appreciate you. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.